All right. Hello, everyone. Very happy Wednesday. And Jacqueline, I enjoyed your teaching very, very much. Sorry you didn't know that it was an hour. But yeah, that slot before me, for some reason, has always been an hour slot. We had Gina Lake in it, and then we had Nirmala in it. And then I think Sharon was in it for a short time. So yeah, I'm glad you're happy to have an hour. Good. So we are here now for the Guiding Light, and what I'm doing with the Guiding Light is the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And before I get started on that, I'm going to play a song. This is a Native American country and Western song. So if you don't listen to Native American country and Western, the sound of it may be a little different. Oh, in fact, let me add another word to this, Kathy. It's a Native American country and Western gospel song. How's that? Native American country and Western gospel song. it's by a Native American Christian singer. His name is Johnny Curtis. And the name of the song is Help Me to Understand You.
Oh Lord, please help me to understand you. Lord, you know I mean no one but you. When you know that we abide, trials come on every side. Oh Lord, please help me to understand you. Oh, why should I feel discouraged when I know you've done so much for me? When trouble comes through everyone, but then I know your will is done. Oh, Lord, please help me to understand you. I know you beside me. When I walk, I know you will guide me. Oh Lord, you know I'll obey. Why can't others see this way? Oh Lord, please help me to testify for you. When I know you've done so much for me. Every time when I feel led, I stand and seems I fail instead. Oh Lord, please help me to understand you. Oh Lord, please help me to understand you.
There we go. Johnny Curtis. All right, so as I mentioned, we are here for the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, and I am beginning on page 26 in the section called Practice with question number 16. So this is the question. What are the factors to be kept in view in dhyana? Dhyana being devotion, typically. And last week we saw it as meditation. And last week what we really saw was, because of the questioner's questions, Ramana Maharshi talked about the difference between dhyana and samadhi, and said that dhyana is achieved through deliberate mental effort, meaning spiritual practice. You know, you sit down, you close your eyes, you practice self-inquiry, You abide in awareness as awareness. And through this practice, you lose consciousness of the body and the world for a temporary period of time. Dhyana, devotion. Samadhi, he said, there is no such effort. Because samadhi occurs after the death of the ego. It's the natural state that the sage abides in. It's the natural state of no body, no world, even though we see a body and see a world and talk to a sage in a body. It's that natural state of abiding in pure awareness without the awareness of a body or a world. So that leads us to question number 16, which the answer is almost a full page long. The question is, what are the factors to be kept in view in dhyana or devotional meditation? Ramana Maharshi begins, it is important for one who is established in his self to see that he does not swerve in the least from this absorption. By swerving from his true nature, he may see before him bright, and then here's a word I don't know, and I think I know what it means, sort of, but we'll look it up to be sure, but I just don't even know how to say it. It's effulgences. Well, let's just pause and look it up. So let me spell it for you guys, since I may be really saying it wrong. And you're like, what? Maybe some of you are more educated than me regarding vocabulary, and you'll recognize it immediately. To me, it's a word I don't use. It's not a part of my vocabulary at all. So I'm going to go look it up. I think I know what it means. I think it means like visions, right? You'll see things in your meditation. Well, let's look and see if I'm right. Yeah, it just says shining bright or radiant. Shining brightly or radiant. So maybe you see great lights, right? Shining brightly or radiant. Reminds me of the story of the yogini, where when she was in meditation, she saw these bright, shiny beings, right? So effulgent, it looks like. Effulgent. Okay, so anyway, so much for a vocabulary lesson. By swerving from his true nature, he may see before him bright effulgence or hear unusual sounds or regard as real the visions of gods appearing within or outside himself. He should not be deceived by these and forget himself. And there's more to this answer, but I'm going to pause there before we go on. So we know then that dhyana, as it is interpreted by Ramana Maharshi, is being devoted to meditation, devoted to the practice. And we could say that dhyana resides on this side of ego death, right? On this side of ego death. So it's the one who still has an ego that practices dhyana. But we know, because we've heard these stories before, the yogini story I've shared with you many times, we know that when one is deep in meditation, one can have what appears to be spiritual experiences. And what Ramana Maharshi is saying is these spiritual experiences are actually, I'm going to call it the devil here, the devil deceiving you. I'm calling it the devil because it's almost like that aspect of the ego. That aspect of the ego that does not want us to cross over, right? Wants us to stay on this side, attached to the ego. So I'm going to call it the devil, if you don't mind. So it's the devil deceiving us. I've told you the story of the yogini many times, but I'm also reminded of another story. Ramana Maharshi had an attendant who wanted to go and sit in a cave and practice self-inquiry. And, of course, Ramana Maharshi gave him that permission. And I don't know how long this attendant was there. But one day he came running back to Ramana Maharshi very excited to tell him about an experience that he had while he was in the cave meditating and practicing self-inquiry. He saw a temple burning in his mind's eye, right in his meditation. And then later on, some visitors came by the cave, as happens in India. People come and feed you and sit and stare at you and that kind of thing while you're meditating. So some people came by the cave and they told him that about a temple, you know, I don't know where it was, nearby, some a few towns away or something, but he told them about this temple that did in fact burn that morning. And he became very excited that he had developed this power to be able to see this temple that was some towns away burning in his mind's eye. And he felt like he had really achieved something. And so he ran down to Ramana Maharshi all excited to tell him about this achievement. And Ramana, in effect, told him that he was not yet ready and to go back to being his attendant because he was too easily distracted. When I first started awareness watching, awareness meditation, I don't know how long, when I say I first started, I really don't know if this was 6 months into it or 9 months into it. I don't know. But one day when I was practicing awareness watching, awareness meditation, a vision appeared in my mind's eye. There was like this long, long tunnel, like a dark tunnel. And I was kind of pulled down this tunnel. And when I came out of the tunnel, I was in a cave, but the cave was lit by candles or something. I really didn't notice. But the cave was brightly lit. Oh, there was a fire. That's right. There was like a campfire in the cave. And there were people sitting around the campfire talking. And one person had his back to me, but I knew instantly who it was. It was Ramana Maharshi. And I knew, you know, as sure as I've ever known anything, that I could walk up to Ramana Maharshi in this experience and I could ask him anything and he would answer me. But then I remembered these teachings we're talking about right now. I remember that when you're in awareness, watching awareness teach meditation, you ignore everything and just abide as awareness. And so I returned my attention to awareness, watching awareness, and the vision faded away. This is what Muji is teaching when he tells the story of the yogini. This is what Ramana Maharshi is teaching here. We are not to be distracted by what may seem to be holy encounters during meditation. We are to stay with awareness, watching awareness, and ignore everything else. That is, it's just attempting to bring our attention back outward, outward to the vision, outward to the excitement of an opportunity to interview Ramana Maharshi. So again, what are the factors to be kept in view? I would say that the way an American would ask that question is, you know, what do I need to keep in mind when I'm meditating? What do I need to keep in mind when I'm meditating? What are the factors to be kept in view in dhyana? So it is important for one who is established in his self to see that he does not swerve in the least from this absorption. By swerving from his true nature, he may see before him bright effulgences, or hear unusual sounds, or regard as real the visions of gods appearing within or outside himself. He should not be deceived by these and forget himself. There's also a story. The name of the book is No Mind, I Am the Self. But the book isn't really published anymore. I feel blessed to have a copy of it. But sometimes you can find things on Amazon. But in this book, there's a woman whose name I don't remember. She's working with a guru. And in the book, she becomes awake. And I guess what's really interesting about her experience is there was literally a tape recorder running when she had her awakening experience. So it is transcribed into the book just as it happened from the tape. But one of the things that happened just prior to her awakening, she is Indian. And so Shiva, you know, is a god that she loves, like a person from our culture might love Jesus, for example. Or like I obviously love Ramana, which is why I saw Ramana in my vision. But she loves Shiva. And so what happened to her is Shiva came to her. And Shiva invited her, and again, this is like a vision, but it's a very real type of experience. Shiva invited her to come with her, with him, to other worlds where she could live in like a blissful paradise forever. And she recognized this as one of these temptations. And of course refused Shiva and then awoke, you know, a short time after that. So it's interesting to be aware of these tricks because, as you can see, they're things that will really grab you. You know, like, she loves Shiva, and here's Shiva showing up, inviting her to go and live in other worlds, in bliss and paradise forever. You know, I saw Ramana Maharshi, and I could have asked him anything. You know, so it's important to be aware that this is, I'm going to call it again, the devil, that part of the ego that is really trying to deceive us, right? This is the devil, the same devil that Jesus saw in his 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, really trying to deceive us. And it tries to deceive us with holy tricks because holy is our interest now, right? That's our interest now, the best way to deceive us. All right, so I'll read that paragraph one more time, and then I'll continue because there is more to this answer. So again, the question is, what are the factors to be kept in view in dhyana? It is important for one who is established in his self to see that he does not swerve in the least from this absorption. By swerving from his true nature, he may see before him bright effulgences or hear unusual sounds, or regard as real the visions of gods appearing within or outside of him. He should not be deceived by these and forget himself. And then it says note, but there are four separate notes. So note number one. If the moments that are wasted in thinking of the objects, which are not the self, are spent on inquiry into the self, self-realization will be attained in a very short time. And again, the person asks, you know, what should I keep in mind, you know, if I'm practicing awareness, watching awareness, or self-inquiry meditation? And one of the answers is, if the moments that are wasted in thinking of the objects which are not the self are spent on inquiry into the self, self-realization will be attained in a very short time. So I would imagine that at least some of you have the same type of experience that I have when I go into meditation. You know, I go into meditation and the mind wants to think. And of course, on some days I fall for that more. And on other days, you know, I'm able to turn my attention away from that better, right? But obviously what's being impressed upon us here is that if we can have the discipline, that instead of letting the attention go to whatever the mind wants to think about when we're in meditation, if we can have the discipline to inquire into the self instead, he says, self-realization, listen to these exact words, self-realization will be attained in a very short time. That's pretty encouraging. So really, it's up to us to have that discipline. And I would say that discipline actually comes from the desire, right? From really wanting to know the self. You know, like when Jacqueline was teaching in the hour before, she taught about someone who went to Papaji's door and said something like, you know, I'm really ready to awake, to be awake, or something like that. I don't remember the exact sentence, but I'm really ready to be awake. You know, if we're really ready to be awake, then we're not going to be as interested in sitting there with our eyes closed and thinking about what I did yesterday and what I got to do tomorrow and what so-and-so said, right? When that type of a distraction, which is not a holy distraction, it's an everyday distraction, when that type of distraction arises, we will practice self-inquiry. And I think it's really helpful if we remember, again, this sentence, because it's a very encouraging sentence for someone who really does want to awaken. If the moments that are wasted in thinking of the objects, which are not the self, are spent on inquiry into self, self-realization will be attained in a very short time. That's encouraging, don't you think? All right, the second note, number two. Until the mind becomes established in itself, some kind of contemplation of a personified god or goddess with deep emotion and religious feeling is essential. Otherwise, the mind will be frequently assailed by wayward thoughts or sleep. And this is not the first time I've seen this teaching from Ramana Maharshi. Basically, what he is saying is the love that you have for your spiritual symbol. And again, mine would be Ramana Maharshi. I wear a necklace with Ramana Maharshi around my neck nearly every day. But for some people, it's Jesus. For some people, it might be Buddha. For some, it might be Papaji, right? It doesn't really matter what your spiritual symbol is. But if you have this spiritual symbol that really wakes up your heart and that you just love, that when you're a beginner, it can be helpful to really contemplate that personified God with deep emotion and religious feeling. Because that opens your heart and brings you into the meditation in a more vibrant way. And that way you're less likely to just sit there and think with your eyes closed or fall asleep. Now, this isn't much different from what Michael Langford teaches in how to live a life that knows only love when he's teaching the loving consciousness meditation. Because in the instructions to the loving consciousness meditation, what he recommends is that you think about the person you love the most. He says, or it could even be a pet. You know, think of the person you love the most. So you close your eyes, and again, this is for beginners, but you close your eyes and you think of the person you love the most. And you really allow yourself to go deeply into the love you feel for that person or that pet or that personified God. And then you take that love and then you apply that love to awareness or consciousness or the self. If we can go into meditation with a heart-open feeling of love, again, we're less likely to just sit there and think with our eyes closed or to fall asleep. So for those to whom this recommendation fits, you know, we see Ramana Maharshi making it again. Until the mind becomes established in itself, some kind of contemplation of a personified god or goddess with deep emotion and religious feeling is essential. Otherwise, the mind will be frequently assailed by wayward thoughts or sleep. And again, this is why prior to meditation, I read. I read whatever is currently inspiring me, really opening my heart. And when I read something that I'm really guided to read, I do feel that love. You know, reading and contemplation opens up that love to me and I fall into that love. And then from that state of having fallen into that deep devotional love, that's where I begin my meditation. If I attempt to meditate without taking that time to open the heart, then I'm much more likely just to close my eyes and sit there and think. number three. Oh, and some people, by the way, another one of Michael Langford's recommendations, which might work for some people. I found that the reading works best for me. But he also recommends another possibility is to listen to heart-opening music before you meditate. Right? So any music that really opens your heart. Listen to a couple, three songs, and then close your eyes and go into meditation. Note number three. Without spending all the time in practicing, like I am Shiva or I am Brahman, which are regarded as contemplation of the attributeless Brahman, the method of inquiry into oneself should be practiced as soon as the mental strength, which is the result of such practice, is attained. Okay, so again, you know, Ramana Maharshi, it seems, often spoke with these sentences that just go on and on and on. So they're like, the sentence is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines long. It's like a whole paragraph. but most of us are aware of some type of what I'm going to call early meditation practice. You know, some people watch the breath. It looks like probably a common practice in Ramana's culture was to close the eyes and say, I am Shiva, or I am Brahman. Or in my case, you know, I might close my eyes and practice, I am that I am, right? And what he's really pointing out here is these types of practices, their real purpose is only to discipline the mind, or what he calls it here, to acquire mental strength. And by mental strength, of course, what he means is where we're able to focus attention where we want to focus attention instead of attention just running off and chasing thoughts. It reminds me of A Course in Miracles where it's disciplined mind can accomplish nothing. So he's saying for the beginner, it may be helpful to have some kind of a preliminary practice, you know, and you might call that meditation, but really to him, it's just a mind strengthening technique. Sometimes sit, you know, and learn to concentrate, for example, on a sentence. Or I think some people do. I've never done TM, but TM gives you like a little sound to concentrate on, right? So he's saying it may be helpful once you have the mental strength so that you're not so susceptible to mind wandering or falling asleep, then you should abandon those early practices and instead self-inquiry. And if you all were in gentle healing last night, then you saw that self-inquiry is what Rupert Spira called seeking question. And the seeking question, it's asking a question that the mind can't return the attention to awareness. And the mind kind of quiets, and instead is the looking. The mind goes quiet and the looking kicks in. The looking is looking for the answer. It's really bringing attention to awareness, or awareness to awareness, right? And so the seeking question, obviously, that Ramana Maharshi taught is, who am I? The form of that I tend to practice is, what am I? Another good question might be, what is consciousness, or what is awareness? But what these seeking questions do is they turn the attention to look inward, to discover the answer through direct experience. You can imagine that if you were trained to do something like meditate on I am Shiva, or meditate on a sound like Om or some other sound, or I am that I am, with your imagination and experience, that your mind can become fixed on that object of thought. But the object of thought is actually still in a slightly outward direction. So what happens is your mind becomes fixed on an outward position. It's no longer wandering around. You may even experience a lot of peace there because all of the other thoughts may seem to die away as you're focused on this one thought. But the attention is still fixed in an outward position rather than an inward position. It's not turning around and looking prior to the mind at awareness. It's staying with one thought in mind. So he says, once you develop that mental discipline to stay with one thought in mind, to the exclusion of all other thoughts, then shift your practice to the seeking question, what am I or who am I, which now takes your attention and goes inward to look prior to the mind. What can I find prior to the mind, prior to thought? And then the fourth note, the excellence of the practice lies in not giving room for even a single mental concept. Again, you know, often, you know, Ramana Maharshi speaks about great discipline in meditation. And the great discipline he speaks about is certainly beyond my current achievement. Who knows, maybe I'll do it tomorrow. But, you know, up to this point and in the past, you know, I can't say that I can sit in meditation for hours without giving room for even a single mental concept. But what I can say is in the times when I am able to do that for as little as 10 minutes. I don't know that I've ever done it longer than that, not allow a single mental concept. The meditation goes very deep. And if I can sometimes do that for 10 minutes, then I can probably strengthen that muscle. And really, I think, and this I don't know, so take this with that grain of salt. I think what's really happening when we sit in meditation and we practice in this way is we are literally reprogramming the brain. And the brain is malleable. The brain can be reprogrammed. And so when we first start meditating, you know, it's called an undisciplined mind, but really it's a mind that's conditioned to wander. And so now what we're doing is we're taking that brain, which is conditioned to just, you know, wander and think all the time, and we're learning to fix it in one position and hold it there. Yeah, she says we are reprogramming the receptors. And that takes practice. That takes reprogramming. But then once we've learned to hold that mind on a fixed position, we now begin a deeper use of that disciplined mind or that reprogrammed brain by going and looking for consciousness, going and looking for the self, going prior to the mind. So that was the answer to question number 16. What are the factors to be kept in view in Dhyana? The first one was, don't be deceived by the devil. No matter how holy he dresses himself, right? Don't be deceived by the devil. The second was, instead of wasting your time thinking during meditation, practice self-inquiry. The third one was, use some type of love, whether it's a love for a personified God or, you know, you open your heart through reading like I do or through music or whatever way you do it. Don't just sit down and close the eyes without first opening the heart. You'll have better results. The next one was if you need to use some type of a practice like focusing on a mantra in order to discipline the mind. But once the mind is disciplined, abandon the mantra and go to self-inquiry. And then the last tip was that really the best practice, and Michael Langford says this in his book too, the best practice is the one where there are no thoughts. Now the way Ramana Maharshi worded it is the excellence of the practice lies and not giving room for even a single mental concept. All right. Question number 17. What are the rules of conduct which an aspirant should follow? And here is the answer. Moderation in food, moderation in sleep, and moderation in speech. You know, the way that I would interpret that is, you know, don't let your ego just whip you around all day. You know, I mean, our ego whips us around in how we eat, right? Oh, I got to go get a cookie. I got to get another cookie. I got another cookie. I mean, that's just the ego whipping us around, isn't it? Right? The ego whips us around maybe in our television watching habits. The ego can it can rush some people around by having them sleep way too long, and other people don't sleep enough, right? They're too busy, too involved in other activities. They don't get enough sleep. So don't let the ego just whip you around. The ego, oh, I want this, and go do it. Oh, spending money, shopping, right? Hanging out in Facebook. So when Ramana Maharshi, I mean, he only gives three choices here, moderation in food, moderation in sleep, and moderation in speech. But what I really hear there is pay attention to what you know is good for you and live that way. You know, none of us are idiots. Somehow we know what's good for us and what's not. We may not follow what we know, right? But we know. You know, we know it's not good to eat 20 cookies a day. Is there anybody here that really thinks eating 20 cookies a day is good for you? We know it's not good. I love, I don't know if you guys heard Craig Holiday on Sunday night, but in a way he was addressing this. Now you want a cookie. In a way he was addressing this. He talked about how intuitively he just suddenly felt to go to a friend's house. And he went to the friend's house, and he said he honked as he was pulling up because the friend lives in the country, and he didn't want to surprise the friend, you know. And so he honked as he was pulling into the driveway. There was also a dog, so the dog might have barked. He says then he went up, and he, I don't know if he rang the doorbell or knocked or whatever, but you know, nobody answered. But the door was unlocked, so he went on in. And he found his friend passed out on the sofa or in a recliner or something, passed out with a glass of wine watching reality TV. What is that show? I've never watched it, but I think I've vaguely heard it. It's like Honey Boo Boo or something. I don't know. Maybe some of you guys know. And he's like, you know, this person didn't even have the awareness or the consciousness to know I'm tired now. You know, let me turn off the TV and put myself in bed. Right? I mean, this is what I think Ramana Maharshi is talking about. We just let the ego just sling us around. Watch meaningless reality TV. Have a glass of wine, even though you're dead tired. You know, pass out so that you can pass out with a glass of wine in your hand, watching Honey Boo Boo or whatever that show is called. Today I actually wrote the first tip for year two of Gentle Healing, which you guys will see in a week. And even after I write a tip, I continue to contemplate it because it's my lesson for the day, right? So it deepens. And really what the tip is about is kind of the difference between what people would call conscience and spiritual intuition. And conscience has a role. The role of conscience is to teach us exactly what we're talking about now. The role of conscience is to guide us in a wholesome way. You know, eating right, sleeping right, you know, saying the right things instead of the wrong things to people, right? That's conscience's role. And, of course, when we ignore our conscience, you know, then ego just whips us around, you know, and we do whatever. Spiritual intuition is deeper than conscience. Spiritual intuition, its role is to awaken us to consciousness. But conscience has a role to keep us living in a healthy and happy way. When we don't listen to our conscience, we complicate our lives, and therefore there's more suffering. Right? Like if you eat 25 cookies a day, don't you actually suffer from that? Right? So he's really talking about following that conscience that we were all given that knows the right way or the best way for us to live so that we reduce the complications in our life, reduce the suffering in our life, and therefore we're going to be more available to spiritual intuition, which will come to awaken us. But if we don't listen to our conscience and we're doing all of these things that aren't healthy for us, we're actually less available to spiritual intuition because of the complications we have created. Some people just simply use the word simplify when they're talking about this. Simplify your life. You know, let go of all the complications, all the things that you know aren't necessary to your life. Thich Nhat Hanh would talk about replacing unwholesome practices with wholesome practices. And actually, my dad would call this common sense. And I think my dad might be right. It's a shame how many of us don't listen to common sense. My dad has always taught me that the majority of the suffering that people experience, my dad doesn't say all of the suffering because, you know, he's not a spiritual man. But he says the majority of the suffering that people experience, they bring upon themselves because they don't listen to common sense. And he's right. Yeah, mindful living is another way of saying it. So, what are the rules of conduct which an aspirant should follow? Moderation in food, moderation in sleep, moderation in speech. We'll just call it mindful living for now. Number 18. How long should one practice? The answer is, until the mind attains effortlessly its natural state of freedom from concepts. That is, till the sense of I and mind exists no longer. You know, although I don't know if this is a good comparison or not, it's what it's coming to my mind, and I can't shake it out of my mind, so I'll say it. It's like someone asking, how long should I run the race? And the answer is, till you get to the finish line. You know, how long do I run that race? Well, till you get to the finish line. When you get to the finish line, you've finished the race, right? How long should I practice? Well, until you attain your natural state effortlessly, you know, your mind is free of all of those concepts that you used to believe, and that sense of an I and that personal sense of mind, they're completely gone. And I think one thing that is unfortunately popular today is, you know, because there is a truth to the fact that awakeness is already here. The way people word it is, we are already awake. But I think the way that feels more truthful to me is awakeness is already here. But people will hear it stated as, we are already awake, we are already awake. And then it's just, you know, just claim it. Just say, I'm awake. And without any genuine transition that is being described here, in other words, without being able to abide effortlessly in the natural state, without being free from concepts, without being free of the sense of I, or without being free of the sense of mind, people then just claim it and say, I'm awake. But how can you be awake and deluded too? You're either awake or deluded. And if you still suffer the symptoms of delusion, then you must not be awake. At least that's the way I look at it. You know, maybe I'm the one idiot on the planet Earth and everybody else is right. But to me, if you still suffer the symptoms of delusion, you must not be awake, even if awakeness is here. So how long should I continue my practice? Until you no longer suffer the symptoms of delusion. How long should one practice? Until the mind attains effortlessly its natural state of freedom from concepts. That is, till the sense of I and mine exists no longer. And I think that we probably know when the sense of I and mine exists no longer, right? If we want to be honest with ourselves. Number 19, what is the meaning of dwelling in solitude? The answer, as the self is all pervasive, it has no particular place for solitude. The state of being free from mental concepts is called dwelling in solitude. So like I have 2 days coming up this week, Thursday and Friday, tomorrow and the next day, when I will be in solitude. But Ramana Maharshi is giving a more strict definition to that word, which I'm fine with. I would say my solitude is the bridge to his solitude, right, to the way he defines it. But I understand his definition. Again, last night when we were in gentle healing, one of the exercises that Rupert Spira led us through was to imagine a room full of people all conversing, you know, big people, little people. I don't remember how he described all the people. He described all these different kinds of people. And he said these people represented thoughts and the space in the room represented consciousness. Well, if we take that example, if our head is full of thoughts, then the space in our room is full of these people. That's not solitude, right? You can't call that solitude if you've got a head full of thoughts, if we use this analogy that Rupert Spira brought. You've got a room full of people there. So Ramana Maharshi is saying that true solitude is being free of all of those mental concepts. The consciousness that you are is empty. It's not filled with thoughts. So I understand his point of view, and I still feel, of course, that the solitude that I am choosing right now is what leads to the solitude. His solitude is the destination. My solitude is the means to the destination, right? Number 20. What is the sign of wisdom? Its beauty lies in remaining free from delusion after realizing the truth once. There is fear only for one who sees at least a slight difference in the Supreme Brahman. So long as there is the idea that the body is the self, one cannot be a realizer of truth, whoever he might be. So what is the sign of wisdom? The first answer, the first sentence. Its beauty lies in remaining free from delusion after realizing the truth once. So for him, you know, when I use the word wisdom, I'm often referring to that spiritual intuition that awakens us. That again is the means. When he refers to the word wisdom, he is talking about total awakening, being completely free of delusion, seeing only truth. So it's almost like, again, you know, my solitude was the means to his solitude. My wisdom is the means to his wisdom. Right? He's talking about the destination when he uses those words. What is the sign of wisdom? Its beauty lies in remaining free from delusion after realizing the truth once. That's really the answer to the question. But then he goes on to say, there is fear only for one who sees at least a slight difference in the Supreme Brahman. So the way that I understand that is, let's imagine the experience of awakening being many, many shifts. And so there's this gradual experience moving away from separation consciousness to unity consciousness. But it's not complete. So there's still something out there that I see as separate from me. Even though I experience a lot of unity with a lot of people, with nature, a lot of peace, there's still something out there. Maybe it's a particular religion that I hold a grievance against. Maybe it's the government. Who knows what it is? Maybe it's people with spiritual ego. Or teachers who have abused their students, some little pet peeve that I still cling to. If I still cling to anything as separate, anything as different than God and myself, then there can still be fear. One only becomes fear-free when there is absolutely no separation remaining. So there is fear only for one who sees at least a slight difference in the Supreme Brahman. Something different from God, different from me. So long, this is the third sentence, so long as there is the idea that the body is the self, one cannot be a realizer of truth, whoever he might be. So he's saying, if you still think I'm the body, right, you aren't even close. So the question was, what is the sign of wisdom? So we could say that he's saying, if you still think you're the body, that's not wisdom. That's not wisdom. And maybe you should begin questioning there. Maybe you should begin by questioning, am I the body? And in a way, this is some of the questioning that we're doing as we play the Rupert Spira games right now. Like one of the games this week is noticing that the body experiences the world through the senses. But I am watching or aware of the body's experience. You see, so that's separating the I from the body. That's questioning the I am the body idea. So we want to separate ourselves from the idea, I am the body. And then I think maybe the next step is to really start to separate ourselves from the idea, I am the mind. But if I think I am the body, that is not wisdom. I'm completely deluded regarding what I am. I can't be completely deluded regarding what I am and be the presence of wisdom too, right? You're either deluded or you're wisdom. So again, number 20, what is the sign of wisdom? Its beauty lies in remaining free from delusion after realizing the truth once. There is fear only for one who sees at least a slight difference in the Supreme Brahman. So long as there is the idea that the body is the self, one cannot be a realizer of truth, whoever he might be. We have 3 minutes left. This next question is short. Let's see if we can do it. Number 21. If everything happens according to karma, how is one to overcome the obstacles to meditation? That's a good question. If it's my karma to fall asleep during meditation, I'm screwed, right? That's the way I would ask the question. So his answer is, the result of one's acts in the past concerns only the outturned, not the interned mind. One who seeks his real self will not be afraid of any obstacle. That's the answer. The way that I hear that answer is, do not use your tendencies as an excuse. And in fact, there's another quote. Let me see if I can find it really quick. This is a Ramana Maharshi quote from the Seven Steps to Awakening. It's one of my favorite quotes. It's in Step 5. All right, let's see. Here, this is quote number 872 in the Seven Steps to Awakening, and it's Ramana Maharshi. Since it was one's own past effort that now has ripened into fate, one can, with greater present effort, change one's fate. In other words, he doesn't see karma as an excuse. So what? You may have the tendency to fall asleep during meditation, but you can overcome that, you know. Start with focusing on love before you meditate. Make sure you're getting enough sleep and eating right. You know, he doesn't buy into this. This is my karma. That's it. I can't meditate, you know, because I have bad karma. You know, which is more of an Indian excuse than an American excuse. But he's saying that you can overcome any tendency with present effort. So again, quote 872 from the Seven Steps to Awakening, since it was one's own past effort that now has ripened into fate, one can, with greater present effort, change one's fate. And then the question 21 in the book, if everything happens according to karma, how is one to overcome the obstacles to meditation? Answer, the results of one acts in the past concerns only the outturned, not the interned mind. One who seeks his real self will not be afraid of any obstacle. You know, if you want it bad enough, you're going to keep putting effort in that direction and you will succeed. All right, that's the end of my time, so I am releasing the mic. Thank you, everyone.